Hey, what up? This is Swamp Fiends. Today we are talking, I got hopefully a pretty fun conversation planned with a couple of friends. So today I have Nick on from the Capital City Conference. How you doing, Nick? What have you been playing?
Oh yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Mostly been playing Cry, I guess. I know that's like what everyone's doing, but I mean, it's so much fun.
Is that what everyone's doing?
I don't know. I keep talking to people that also play Cry, and half the people I play against are like, yeah, I played against Cry a lot. And it's, yeah, I don't know. Seems odd to me, but.
Yeah, I feel like Shtuk is the internet's like baby, like boogeyman, but Cry is a real stinker.
I think Shtuk just has like a super high floor. So it's just like you can just battleship your way into a victory so fast.
And that second voice is Mr. Oliver from also from Cap City. How are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, pretty good. My feet hurt. Nick convinced me to walk. I think it was like some 7 miles in some park in the godforsaken wilderness. But other than that, that was pretty sweet, though. But other than that, yeah, life's good. I mean, I've got my dog. I've got my shitty little apartment. And I have video games with my friends because there's a plague.
Nick convinced you to walk 7 miles in the woods in the dark right before this?
This was over the weekend. We went hiking in Honest Park. Man, that would have been a wild start to the podcast. Yeah, so we had to walk 7 miles to get to this shitty 7-Eleven. Now we're hooked up to some Wi-Fi from a hotel and we're recording a podcast. No, that's not what happened. This was like 2 days ago. I'm just a bitch and my feet still hurt.
I feel you, dude. Sometimes my feet hurt after like at the end of a Malifaux tournament, my feet hurt so much. And like my wife never has less respect for me when I'm like laying up on the couch complaining about my feet hurting because I played War Dollies all day.
It's pretty funny. Yeah. Anyone who's worked retail like knows that a human being just shouldn't be like doing that consistently on like hard concrete, and it's not great.
Well, I'm glad to hear that like Nick wasn't trying to get you lost in the woods.
So I wasn't trying to murder him.
No, if Nick ever wanted to murder me, I would just be dead. Like it's not it wouldn't be hard. It would be probably pretty easy, actually. So yeah.
I don't know if that's an indictment of Nick or yourself.
Yeah, definitely me. Yeah, it's 100% me. Yeah.
All right. So today I wanted to talk about something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I thought about these two guys because we went back and forth about doing an episode before talking about summoners and how to like improve play with them and how to get better with them. And then you guys... Nick wrote an article about summoning that got a lot of backlash on like AWP because talking in text is very hard. Like the number one thing I got from your article was like talking about the game in person is so much different than in text. Because if you say to me, like I'm texting back and forth with Oliver and he'd be like, you know, summoners are busted. And I'm like, that's weird. I don't think they're busted. But if you were to just say summoners are busted to me, I'd be like, yeah, of course they are. So anyway, and then you guys did the summoner debate episode with Kyle on Schemes and Stones, and the thing I got from that, because I think you guys like kind of like negotiated your way towards the middle from both sides of the pro and like anti-summoning debate, but the thing I think that you guys talk about that does not get talked about enough is the like ability to trade AP for AP, or trading like I feel like you guys understand that equation better than most people in a way that is super interesting. So I wanted to talk to you guys about basically a thought that Jimmy and I have been talking about before, which is designing lists, thinking about the principle of like MSU from other games. So just for a little bit of historical context, if you didn't play 40K or like fantasy or something like that, you probably did. MSU stands for multiple small units. And it was like the competitive way to win games like back when I actually thought 40K was a good game or something. And what that did is, like, you would basically, instead of bringing one big unit, you would group it up into multiple small units. And the reason you did this is because it gave you flexibility and the ability to cover more space, because you can send half here, half there. But the thing that was strongest, I thought, was that it allows you to throw things away. And when you're able to just give up pieces in this game, in all tabletop games, I think that puts you in a very strong position that doesn't get discussed when we're just reading the cards. And it allows you to, like, force trades and things like that. Mm-hmm. So basically what I wanted to talk about with you guys is, like, how can we bring those ideas to Malifaux in ways that hasn't already been done? So to start that off, I guess, like, could one of you explain to me just sort of briefly, like, maybe the math behind trading like a summoner AP for, like, basically taxing your opponent's AP with, you know, this ability to throw things away?
Yeah, Nick, do you want to get this one?
I'll hop in that. Yeah, so, like, okay. A lot of it's to do with the model you're summoning and where you're putting it. Because, like, if you're just summoning a model, it's kind of whatever. But, like, some summons are not as great. Like, I would say, like, Big Morning summon, because it goes base to base with them. But the positioning is so big. I feel like the easiest way to think about it is, like, you're putting out a reverse Soulstone Miner because of, like, the way it gives it back your stones. And you put it in the best spot it can go. And if you put it on top of one of your opponent's models and your summoning has, like, a decent tankiness to it, it's going to take a lot of actions to remove that model to, like, get it out of the way. And if you're putting on someone that wants to do a scheme or something, they can't do it when you're sitting there engaged. Or if they're, like, trying to kill a different model, well, suddenly they have to deal with this one in front of you. And so, like, you're forcing them to interact with it, which is burning more actions from them than the actions you spent doing that thing. So that's kind of, like, the basis behind, like, my arguments before, is you're spending one action and trading it up for multiple actions out of that. So, like, you're gaining multiple actions just from this, like, putting this model in this weird spot. And that's just, like, the start of it. So, because that model could also do stuff. But a lot of it's just due to you're kind of taking away actions from your opponent by forcing them to interact with you. When a lot of times certain crews can just, like, ignore you, like Colette, their whole crew can just, like, ignore you and put down schemes, whatever, don't mind me. Like, but for most of the crews in the game, forcing them to interact with you is, like, not really great for them.
The other part to it too, which adds to that math and just makes it more occluded and confusing, is that sometimes it forces someone to change their order of activation when they really needed to do whatever the thing is next. So it's not always just a minus one AP or minus two AP. Sometimes it deletes a specific important AP out of their ability for the rest of the game, right? Like, so you get in these situations where you're not really just taking an AP away, but you're just stealing a whole point, right? Or you're stealing opportunities later for them to set up to do a score, scheme strat, whatever. So I think that's part of it too. And that math starts to get really occluded really fast, especially when it's like, okay, well, my guy's stuck now, so I can't do that right now. Okay, well, I'm going to move this other guy and then I'll come back to this once I deal with it. And then that allows you to keep screwing up their Roose Goldsberg machine, so it just never goes off.
Yeah, I think at the base level, like, the math is sort of like you spend one summoner action, a card, and a stone, and then your opponent has to spend maybe three-ish actions to remove that model. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, excluding, like you said, you know, the actions that the model gets, you know, the card that model may have to spend to, like, remove that model, right? Because because the deck has such a wide variance, like the difference of, like, def 5 versus attack stat 6 doesn't really matter unless you're willing to spend the card on it. So, like, you can easily get yourself in a situation where, you know, we're just top decking and you just never win because the deck is so swingy in that, in terms of, like, comparing the stat. But yeah, right. Like you said, I think the important caveat to all of this is, like, sort of none of this matters if we're talking about this in a, I guess, like a theoretical GG where a lot of kills don't really, I guess I don't even have to say theoretical GG. In this GG even, like, mm-hmm. certain kill, like most of the kills you do don't actually matter that much.
Right. Yeah, pretty much.
You can get like a really weird like pool or something, but it's like three or four things have to like really hit the bullseye for it to turn into like death matters.
Yeah, other than the base like Malifaux win condition, which is I kill enough of your models that you can't score points. That's sort of like Malifaux 1.0. That's
yeah, how it's it condition. Works. It's condition zero. It's always the win condition.
Yes. That's a perfect way to say it. Condition zero. I like that. And then obviously if your opponent is, if it's a scheme pool where like, if you have these chaff models, you know, these really inefficient to kill models, and they're scoring points off of it, that sucks. Like this, like ignore that part of your brain for this conversation. And like also ignore like Von Stuck killing models and summoning models, you know, those mechanics that make like chaff models, like a liability, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So the assumption is you can always just draft not this into whatever those lists are, right? Like they're all fairly telegraphed. I can't think of anything that's not like if my opponent says answer Stuck, I immediately know what their game plan is. I can't think of someone who hard counters that core strategy that isn't immediately telegraphed from the master announcement.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that, in thinking about what you said before, which is like attrition is win condition zero, I think there's another win condition that people don't think about enough, which is that the game sort of ends at five turns, right? So if you tax your opponent's models enough, the game is over, regardless of like how bad the, you know, the battlefield looks for you. The game is over, and then you score points, right?
Yeah. So, it's interesting. We've actually talked about this before as a resource. There's only so many actions in the action pool. So like if each turn's a pool of stuff, like you have an ocean of actions, that's only 40 or 50. So if you just waste enough of them, you also can win the game.
Yeah. And yeah, that's like I'm writing a 5-paragraph essay of this episode. That's what I want the first sentence to be, right?
Yeah.
It's that if you tax, like regardless of what models exist, if like taxing them is a win condition, and I think people don't think about that as a win condition when writing lists, insofar that like a lot of lists are written to that win condition zero. You know, I'm going to bring these three models. I'm going to bring these two support models that make those three models never die. I'm going to give them three upgrades because why not have better models? And then that's win condition zero, right? Those three models are going to punch a big enough hole that you can't score mm-hmm. your points and I'm going to score my points. But with this other win condition, what you're saying is like exactly what you're saying, where those three models only get five times two, they get 50 actions, right? And if you make them spend 35 of them punching chaff or something like that. Did I do that math right? I did not do that math
right. It's math, so it's always right.
Yeah, whatever.
Not right, but sure.
So if you tax their actions enough, then you win the game based off of you just having more actions.
Yeah, I can't think of as cool a name as win condition zero, but it's definitely the other, like, you know, the alpha and the omega of the two win conditions that exist in all game states. And it's funny. I know one of the things that you and I have always fairly aggressively disagreed on is I've always looked at time as a resource, and I know you don't like that a lot. But I think that if time exists as a resource, this other win condition, for lack of a, we'll just call it win condition alpha, right? So for this alpha win condition, it gets significantly bigger and more of a pressure the less time exists in a game. And there's two states to it, right? There's the actual win condition alpha, and then there's the projected one. The projected one being, okay, we go to five turns. The actual being, okay, but when does my opponent actually stop playing?
Yeah.
Due to time constraints or whatever, which it still exists, right? I mean, if we're showing up to an event, round one, you never know who you're going to get. But it kind of lends credence to that existing, right? I mean, if we can infer that this is another one of these win conditions that exist outside the game state, it's just kind of interesting. I'd never thought of it until you started talking about it, like, in the way you were presently.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I'm hesitant to say that they're the same, right? Because, like, time is not a win condition in the rule book.
No, it's just a resource.
Like, turn five is a win condition in the rule book, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, it's just a factor in the it's like a piece of math in the calculation. It's not like the actual result of it, but it's just interesting. I'd never thought of it as a part of that equation before.
And we both agree on like time and like it being a problem and like ways to address it. We just don't agree on like the initial like data point that like drives us to the same conclusion, which is probably fine anyway if we're arriving at the same spot. So I think the difference, like our disagreement is like semantic more than anything.
Yeah. I think it's pretty interesting though, because when you look at this as a resource, right? So like kill them all dead. That's like pretty obvious. I think a lot of people have probably already come to that conclusion. But if you look at this AP ocean or whatever or AP pool as this thing that is this hard number. I mean, at the beginning of the game, you can probably figure out what the number is, right? You know, if I have 7 people on my team plus my master, that's 8 models, 7 times 2 plus 3, et cetera, and then times that by 5, you immediately have a number. So every time you waste a lot of actions from your opponent, especially if those actions cost you nothing or little, you're making like big advantages. And this is something that I usually use heavily in my play styles. I mean, a lot of people who see me play are generally going to watch me do this, is always try and tax as much out of that pool as possible, because you never know if your opponent's going to make all the right choices, right? And so all of those taxes become so much more efficient when you add in that variance of like someone not even playing correctly, right? If someone only has 3 mm-hmm. potential actions or activations and they need 2 of those activations on that same model to score and get the full range of points out of it, and you take one of them and they mess one up, well, all of a sudden that's a really big win for you.
Yeah. This win condition basically plays in a way that is like, I feel like anticipates more from your opponent, because you're creating a more narrow win because you're just taxing actions until they don't have enough versus like removing models until they don't have enough, right? So one is like very, you know, it's like once you achieve it, it's like more guaranteed, but the other one I feel like is a slightly more safe, but is like can create a smaller margin. So one thing I was thinking is, so with summoners, what you guys were talking about like on the other episode is like they play to both win conditions simultaneously, and that's why they're particularly strong, is because they're also taxing you while getting attrition advantage. And everyone knows what the board looks like when a summoner wins on attrition, right? Like you summon all the stupid stitch together and they killed all my models because they're insane. But like, so maybe this is a good question for Nick or something. I was especially like eyebrow raised when you guys did that one episode about the Charlotte tournament. And Nick was talking about a list where he brought like nothing but minions in Dreamer. And I feel like that sort of plays to this win condition, especially because you don't even need to have Chompy, you know, flip high cards if you got like all of these minions that are going to drain while also finding attrition advantages. So Nick, I guess I was wondering if you ever found yourself in a, like, I know you've probably got plenty of wins where you just punch people's face in with Dreamer, but do you ever find yourself in a board state where you won because of this win condition we're talking about?
Obviously, that was back in GG0, so like you were punching the hell out of people, but they actually did win a game at that tournament that way against Shtuk, because my opponent, he tried to like take Vincent to try to deny summons, but I like spread my models out in a way where like he couldn't reach everything, and then all the targets were bad. And then I was just mostly engaging his models and trying to keep mine from dying so that he couldn't summon more. and I was barely able to outscore him in that game. So that has happened in several games I played where it just ends up where, like, if they're also a tanky crew, you have to rely more on just trying to, like, make sure they can't score and pushing your model advantage to where they just can't keep up with what you're doing because you have so much movement in that crew. Like, the Daydreams really power that crew for just, like, you can just, like, completely change from one side of the board to the other. Like, you can, like, lure your opponent to, like, all right, I'm putting my models over here. Are you going to come fight them? And then you just, like, use your Daydreams to reposition them. And then they're on the other side of the board. So if they want to keep fighting you, they have to spend all these move actions to, like, reach you and mm-hmm. keep fighting you. It's like, it's, you're, like, burning their actions because you can, it, like, the repositioning is so strong in that crew just because, like, you can just, like, get out of, you can just keep forcing them into situations where, do I try to score myself or, like, do I try to stop him? But yeah. So
it's interesting. This is actually part of the reason I think Ulix is, like, our hidden, like, S tier master. Yeah, I know it's a pile of words. Don't say that.
I took all the ponies out of my cart. I felt bad on Black Friday. I talked myself out of it. I took them all out and I bought the Dark Carnival.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah. I mean, good for you. Good. Like, you need more ways to win. You're like, yeah, I don't know, guys. I guess I could just buy the best master in the game.
Yep.
That might be good. Yeah, but it's the same logic, right? I mean, Ulix can shift his entire team around in a single active, you know, single turn. Literally half of, or maybe a third of the activations on his turn, he can shift his entire crew across all maps. So I think that, like, that kind of, you know, bait and flank or whatever, like, strategy is just, it's just another way to do this same thing. And while summoners obviously leverage themselves into this strategy very easily because they just immediately pressure both, you know, Alpha and Zero, whatever. It, you know, other crews can do this, right? Like, I mean, if you look at, I'm trying to think, Zoraida is probably one of the biggest ones, right? If you look at, like, just the use of Will-O-Wisps, Will-O-Wisps make so many activations bad, right? Like, oh, okay, you're trying to engage this thing. Well, you charged it, so now you're getting negatives against you. I'm going to waste your AP. I'm going to burn you down. And again, it's it's attacking that AP pool instead. And I think that lends itself to a lot of control strategies, mm-hmm. Which is, I think, part of the reason why I play the way I do a lot of the time, is because when you try and leverage your opponent's action pool so heavily, all of a sudden, the lines of play they have start getting really narrow. And then you can predict those lines way easier. And if you can predict them, you can fuck on them. And that's most of control, right? Like, I'm not smart enough to predict all 700 actions you're going to do, right? I'm just going to make every action look like dog shit except for four. And then I'm going to play around those.
Yeah, and that's I feel like that especially works in Malifaux because of the way the control hand works. It's like... Yeah. They get to draw like a 13 and 11 every turn, and that means an action goes through, and you don't have any other say in it, even though it feels like you do, because you're like, I guess I'll spawn for negative. No, they get to do stuff. Like, they don't get to do nothing. Playing don't touch my shit Malifaux like doesn't work. So, like, I feel like these kind of strategies are especially good because it's like, okay, yeah, touch something. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Do it. Touch this Will-O-Wisp. You're going to spend two walk actions. You're going to have to spend a stone to go to positive or maybe even have to focus. And if you don't kill her, she's going to stun you and slow you, you know,
right.
And move to 2 inches, you know, disengage to also put you 2 inches away. So it kills a whole nother action.
Yeah. Like, and sometimes you get your opponent, you just start taxing so many of these that they just have to start like praying, right? Like if you're going into the Will-O-Wisp situation, you're saying, okay, cool. Obviously they focus first because they know they're going to get, you know, the negative flip, whatever, right? But some people are just going to be so pressured because of their own mistakes. All of a sudden, the last activation's happening, and they're like, I'm swinging on a Will-O-Wisp on a negative, and I hope I win.
Yeah.
Right? Because we've all been there, right? And anytime you get in that situation, the ego reaction or the immediate, like, gut instinct is, oh my god, this Will-O-Wisp is broken, and not, man, what did I do 15 turns ago, 15 activations ago, or my list building that made it so I'm in this position right now. But that's the other part. I think it like allowing your opponent as much room to fuck up as possible is really valuable. And I think at least against me, it's pretty good. Like if you give me a lot of like ways to just completely throw myself on the sword, like it looks pretty tasty. I'm going to do it at some point.
Yeah. And I think, Zoraida really pushes on like burning your opponent's actions. Like she's actually her models and herself, just because like obeys are so strong at like, even if you just like obey someone to walk backwards, that is an action they have to burn to get back to like where they need to go. But like, we know that's usually not the case. Like you're actually getting more out of that because you can charge and hit another one of their own models and then burn like focus off of them. So it keeps compounding, and that's like they're forced to like deal with how your potential of taking away their actions and where you can like deny them anything, except like you're trying to deal with these Silurids that both have stealth and butterfly jump, and the same situation, you're trying to go attack them, like you can just never do it efficiently.
Yeah. It's funny you say Zoraida. Like the list I played most recently that was just like an absolute stress test of this idea is I played triple Will-O-Wisp, triple Silurid, Spawn Mother, and a Bokor.
Okay.
Like I scored all 8 points.
It's yeah. Interesting. So I built the list before coming on. I was like, man, I really want to build a sweet Zoraida list. And it's fairly close. I didn't run 3 Will-O-Wisps. Instead, I ran, because I ran out of Bayou, so I ran a single Akaname. And then I ran the Groot Slang with the no bonus action or the 12 cups.
And then, that's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, and then First Mate, just to be able to like get in and crunch something if I really need to. But having the Akaname just allows you to be in these weird situations where you can spend 1 AP on the Akaname, attack something, use its actual suit or whatever to do a second attack on something else, and now you're like in melee with things because it's got a 2-inch melee and they're both slowed and you can still scheme. It just like allows like this weird, it's basically a second Will-O-Wisp, and the third Will-O-Wisp is basically the Groot Slang. It's like you upgrade one and then eat some stones, because the Groot Slang is, it does the same kind of thing, right? And so obviously, if we're talking about this in this way, it's not just necessarily tankiness that creates these situations. It's also eating opponents' attacks, right? Because if your opponent has to walk twice and then they don't have any AP to swing at you, you basically made yourself defense 20. So if you give someone a bunch of, negatives, distracted, whatever, you can also create these situations. It's not as guaranteed as eating people's walks or generating slows and stuff, but yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think you touched on like the most basic way. Like, I feel like everyone has done this at some point where they have a 2-inch reach model and they're engaging a 1-inch reach guy, and that guy who is being engaged really has really bad options. Like, you could walk at that 2-inch reach guy and hit him, or you could try to get out, but like you're always stealing an AP in that situation.
And when they're slowed, it's just that you've time walked them. That model,
like with economy, is not activating at all. That's so silly.
So
yeah.
I mean, if you wrote on a 2-inch melee model instead of, I mean, like I said that wrong. If you wrote on a model's front of card that said, if engaging a 1-inch model, that model gains slow, then people would lose their shit. But they don't really think about 2-inch melee as basically doing the same thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's basically doing that. Yeah.
And there's no flip. You do not have to flip. You don't have to activate anything. All you have to do is end your ass in 2 inches of that person. And a lot of the time, if you have a 2-inch reach, you're touching 2 or 3 things if you're wanting to, right? Or at the very least threatening them so they can't go into the zone you're layering on top of. And I think 2-inch melee is probably one of the most important things in the game in regards to control models. I mean, it's one of the things that makes these lists playable, because if you have a ton of small dudes and there's nothing really going on that's protecting them, they're just going to get swept through. You have to apply these kinds of pressures.
Yeah, like the list I was talking about, triple Will-O-Wisp, really worked because Jimmy was playing Molly. So I knew he was going to primarily have melee models.
Okay.
So I think he killed one of the wisps, you know, like it was just, it was kind of trivial to tax. Like all I did was basically run the spawn mother into the middle while making three eggs. And when she dies, that turns into, you know, three little guppies. So it's just at the, I mean, at the end of the game, you know, I basically had like 10 AP and he had like his dead rider, Archie, Molly, and like the rogue necromancy left. Like even though he had more points left on the board, that's still only 8 actions versus, you know, my 15.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
It makes a big difference. I think that's one of the models that's slept on significantly. I think it's like one of the only other people I can think of right off the top of my head who's like, this model is crazy powerful. I usually have to convince people to put it in their list.
With the Will-O-Wisp?
Yeah. People just don't like it for whatever reason. I mean, the model is like weird, so maybe that's it. Maybe it's just a model that I like the model. So.
I don't get why you don't auto include at least one in Zoraida so that it could punch the doll. So,
but I've had to explain that to so many people.
I guess it's just not immediate because you're not really thinking about. You don't like see the totem card ever. Like,
well, I've seen a couple people's argument basically be like, "Oh, I'll just attack it with something else." Or I'll just use Juju on it, or and I'm just like, you don't want to use big stuff on it. So, but the second one is even more so. Like, I mean, running two or three, I think is very correct. And Silurids also, people very underplay Silurids. I usually see one or two in lists. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it is significantly because for the first part of GG Zero and GG One, you know, until the apocalypse hit, is people focused on Condition Zero. In its entirety almost. And, you know, now the game's maturing in a way and people are starting to look at this other win condition and saying, oh, wait, maybe these models I thought were unplayable are actually really strong because they're the reason they're bad at condition zero is because they're not broken and they're actually really good at this other win condition and they shouldn't have both.
Yeah.
I think the, God, I can't remember what their name, they're like fox people or something. They're Neverborn. Who are the guys I'm thinking of? They're like cavemen with like stone knives and stuff, but they're like foxes. Oh, they're in Savage. Thank you. Jeez. Sorry, that was painful. I don't know. It's quarantine. It's rotted my brain. But yeah.
That's not an easy word to remember, Baltungan.
I guess I can give myself a small bit of relief there. So yeah, but the I think those are another model that, again, is people aren't looking at. They're looking at it from the perspective of, well, this isn't a 9-point, you know, henchman who just one-shots things. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's not what you shouldn't be putting in situations where it's got 6-inch movement. It should always be outside of everyone's melee. So, and I think that when you start looking at these things as value systems, you start seeing these other benefits to a model as, okay, well, how can this benefit this other win condition? So like Nick was saying earlier, he's saying, well, I always had my guys outside of his attack range. If he wanted to go deep on someone, I moved them across the border, shifted them. So they just wasted all these actions getting there. And it's really just a false lure, right?
And Nick touched on it in his like very high level savant like way, but like the most important thing that is wrapped up in these like small models that were talked about is that they pressure walk actions. And that's the MSU like principle that I was like, I wanted to sort of really wrap it into, because when you have a 10 stone model, it has to be in the middle. It has to be relevant. It has to be pressuring multiple points. When you have a Will-O-Wisp, it can sit on the board edge and be doing what it's supposed to be doing. You know, it's either over here dropping a marker. It can never see another model and be fine.
Right.
But that 10-stone model has to be relevant. So you're taxing walk actions because you can do the things you were talking about in that Dreamer game where you're like, well, I just moved all my models where he couldn't, you know, he had to walk charge every one of them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that's like, I feel like the strongest aspect of the sort of MSU little like philosophy that doesn't translate to reading the cards is that you could play a stronger positioning game.
Yeah. And I think, the positioning game, I think that's, and this is what we saw a lot when you looked at Strictly the Worst and a lot of the other big podcasts for Guild Ball, right? They always talked about, I can sit here and talk to you about advice for 10 or 15 hours or 20 hours or, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, you still have to get on the table and play Malifaux. Mm-hmm. And I think that as the community matures, I know we've talked about it a few times. I think the language of the game is it's in a maturing state. It's like finally leaving its infancy. And so now instead of saying, hey, new guy, you just have to play Malifaux, we can instead say, oh, well, before you get into the game, there's two win conditions, right? If you kill all their shit, they can't do anything. If you tie them up the whole game that they literally can't move, they can't do anything. Both of these will win the game regardless of points, right? So like now we can have that conversation with a person so we can explain to them why walking 15 times over the course of a game is really, really bad. Whereas before we just be like, play Malifaux, get, you know, you still got to win.
Yeah. Like the other sort of traditional win condition is like score faster than your opponent. Right.
Right.
So yeah. This is different than that. In that you're not like, it's not like a race as much as it's like, it is control. It is sort of like a control based win condition. Like,
absolutely.
Maybe like, I don't know, like
well, you're trying to, or something. Well, you know that there's a flat cost to scoring points, right? Just like when a restaurant like sets something up, right? They know that there's a flat cost to opening that restaurant. Every plate costs them this much money. You know, same thing for Malifaux. Every actual scheme or strat costs this many actions to do. And so when you go into it and you look at it and everything is underwater, you know you're fucked, right? And the thing is, you're trying to do that to your opponent. You're trying to put them in a situation where at the end of the turn, they say, okay, cool. I need, or beginning of the turn, whichever, you know, I need 12 AP to score my points this turn. I need all of this to do the things I want. And then you go in and you start chipping away at that. Because if that number ever dips below the flat cost, they are going to miss out on points. And so you know what your target is, or you can reasonably assume what that pressure is. And they might not be able to anticipate it because they're just looking at it from the angle of, I got to do these things.
I love flat costs. That's like a perfect way to say it because... like what you like, because points are binary, like you said, like it doesn't matter how good it is until it reaches the threshold where you actually score the point. Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So if you keep chipping away at that, as soon as it goes below the threshold, it doesn't matter if on the front of the card is the craziest actions, abilities you've ever seen, in the back of the card is damage track 4, 8, 9 or whatever, because you've gone below the number of actions you needed to score to go over that sort of like point threshold.
Right. And it's like, cool, you killed all my models, but, or you like did this cool thing, you did something broken, but I'm going to go ahead and put my 6 points down. You got one, good game. Bye. Let me go get a sandwich. Like, it's just like, you still get in these situations where you're just, all right, I'm going to lunch. Like, good for you, kid. Glad your stuff was broken. You know what I mean? Like, there's a certain point where it just doesn't fucking matter. And I think some people struggle with figuring out why. And I think a lot of it is because they're missing this context of these other resources exist in the game and you actually need to manage these as well.
Yeah, I think that's like touching on that. Like when you play GG0MA, it's funny because like watching your games, a lot of times you actually spent that focus defensively and not actually killing them. Like you just use the Rooster Riders, like pick off something, and then the rest of the game, all the focus they had on them was just to defend your schemes.
Yeah,
like to like kind of push it into that.
Now, that's, I guess the follow up to that is, do you think that was correct or do you think that was a wrong use of that focus?
Well, no, it's like you can't always kill everything. Like sometimes they're just all in cover and it just doesn't work. Right. So you just do something else and that crew has the ability just to do that. Like, and then the focus keeps you alive. It wastes more actions on the defense too. Like it's almost as good on the defense sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in some lists. Or again, you said the movement thing, right? I mean, Cody, there are games that I'm sure you saw or you've interacted with where we've played where I've used the 7 movement to make sure I'm, you know, always that second charge away or always the furthest end of something. So I'm like, okay, well, if you want to go for me, it's going to cost you an extra AP now to go after the scheme that you were going to go to, right? And that's before you, you know, okay, well, I'll focus on the defense and here's hoping we just get lucky.
Yeah, I think that's the right play because you're like with the Ma strategy, I felt like was typically to like remove the things you can remove and then delay as much down. As possible. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that was pretty much it. Yeah. She's very good at that.
And she's super good. And then if anything gets crazy, you can always use Ma to just go in, you know, with Gracie pressuring to just crunch one or two last big things, you know, defang them. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just saying, I think that like there's other resources that we haven't found yet in the game. I think that they're like, there's still things that are undiscovered. And I don't think that's just a Malifaux thing. I think that's a, like all miniature games, right? Like using space as a resource, using geography of the map as a resource, all these things. And it'll be interesting to see what models are like shit that aren't actually shit.
Yeah. I did the 100 episode with Craig of Third Floor Wards. And I was trying to get him to say something like that because I was like, What do you think we were most wrong at the beginning of Malifaux, and what do you think the community was most wrong with? And you know, he mentioned something about tiebreakers, but I wanted him to just take a moment to recollect how wrong we have been like constantly over the past like 2 years, and how much I feel like that's going to keep occurring.
Right. Well,
which is the selling point of Malifaux. Like,
yeah, it
gives you space to like be creative within this game, and things are not sort of solved in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's also just not a lot of good players still. I mean, again, the language is so infantile, and it's starting to become juvenile in this instance. But until you get your language into a way, I mean, we were talking about this. I'm not sure if it was recorded or not at the beginning of the cast, but it is so much more difficult to communicate in writing versus just talking to someone. I think that's part of the reason podcasts are fairly popular in the miniature gaming community as a whole. But like, until you get that language in created or developed or whatever, that technology, it's so much harder to bring your garbage players up to decent. And it's so important that you do that, because as a decent player or a good player or pretty good or very good or whatever, all the way up to expert or perfect, like, every time you're playing in someone at your level, you're being intellectually pressured to think of new solutions, right? And the wider the community gets and the deeper that skill gap gets, or the deeper that skill level gets, the more the community is going to keep progressing. And so it's really, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what we think in 2 or 3 years, because I think we're still all pretty terrible.
Yeah. I'll say that, like, obviously I definitely agree with what you're saying, in that it is good that podcasts might elevate like the level of play to some degree, but I don't want to miss the fact that it's also like, when you're building a community of tabletop sort of players, that onus is also on you as an opponent constantly. Like, right. You should, like, I'll read certain things online and I'm like, dude, just fucking give them a take back. Like, someone will be like, oh yeah, like Pride is so good. Like, what can my opponent do against him? He went and he cheated at 13. And I just said, nope, can't do it. It's like, well, just tell him that you're going to remove his 13. Like, you know, I don't know. I'm being like an online reactionary now. I need to chill. I'm using an AWP reactionary. Reading theory. I shouldn't be reacting to fucking online shit, but like,
yeah.
But yeah, that's what, well, I wanted to say when you said we should make our garbage players better, because
yeah,
like, it's also like a community, like, well, people aren't garbage, they just enjoy things differently, but it's also like the community responsibility to, right, like help people enjoy the way that they want to enjoy by making us, like, you know, like I'm saying, like, make them better in a way that's like meaningful for both of you. Like,
yeah, no, I think that's 100% it. But I think, like, I guess the point I was making is that, like, podcasts allow easy communication, but not everyone uses podcasts, and a lot of us interact through text. So as this language technology develops, it'll be easier to express these ideas to other players. So if some guy comes up to me and says, hey, Oliver, I want to play a piglet list, right? I've got this idea to use piglets, and I just want to mass farm them to use them as 3 AP 4-point models. And do you think that's playable, right? Or even simpler, right? Someone comes to me and just says, hey, I like pigs. I'm trying to play a piglet list. What up, right? If the language has developed to a point where I can communicate to that person, okay, well, these models, you know, do these things good. Here's a path to go down. I think that benefits all players, because maybe I'll play against that list one day, right? And I have to play differently. And then I discover a model being stronger in an outside context, like Will-O-Wisp, right? The first few times I played Will-O-Wisp, I thought, okay, they're whatever. And then I got in that situation where I slammed one in between two models, slowed a guy. They're both 1-inch melee, and I just dog fucked two models. So I do agree, though, that people should just play like they want to play, though, because it's all fucking make believe and it's just a game.
Yeah, no, I was just tempering you a little bit, but I definitely agree with what you're saying. There is, like, if we can come up with a better, like, this person wants to play this way, they want to play piglets, they think it's cool, it's better that we have a way to tell them this is how you'll do it than just to say, like, well, it's bad because you can't punch people to death with piglets. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think that it's exciting because Nick and I have been kind of beating the drum about language technology and Malifaux and miniature games as a whole, I think, for most of the pandemic. And it's really cool to see, like you reach out to us about, like, hey, here's this idea I had about, like, how to talk about this really specific thing. And it's like more and more people are kind of having these conversations. So it's like really cool to just see. It's kind of like we just started looking at this as the community was kind of developing this. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a lot more models in the game that probably have these alternative resources or alternative ways of being measured that are actually fairly good. I mean, if you look at the European and British meta versus the American meta, our opinions, our models are so radically different. There's two options, right? Either they're all fucking bad because their state's the size of, I don't know, Minneapolis or something. Like, sorry, their country. Whole country. Okay, yeah. So throw that in there for Gavin if he ever listens, because that's always his argument. So that's option A. Or B, which is probably my argument, you know, Jamie and the rest of you guys don't hate me, is that they are probably valuing other resources than we are, right? So me and Nick value Condition Zero and Condition Alpha a lot. I value Condition Alpha. That's my god. Anytime I interact in a game, that is the only thing I am chasing. That's my first and foremost goal, right? So there's an opportunity here for the British meta to just be focusing on some other condition, right? They might have a Condition Theta or whatever that they are valuing their models on because they have a different play pattern or play style. And that play pattern or play style might be evolving out of them weighing other things, right? They might weigh movement more. They might weigh defense more. They might weigh, you know, free scheme markers more, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But the point is that the fact that they have such a radically different opinion and the rest of Europe as a whole has a radically different opinion, Russia as well, like, that means that there are these other undiscovered continents kind of existing in the game still, which is cool. That's fucking sweet.
I think I also play towards this win condition that we're talking about more sort of dispositionally as well. I think, yeah, I mean, we'll it's also like a personality thing. This is a very risk averse playstyle, which is weird to say that giving away shit for free is risk averse, but it is a way to, like, mitigate flips by basically using space and saying, like, here are the list of possible things and impossible things. And that's what I'm calculating rather than, like, deck math, which is, like, right. Condition Zero. Like, that's what's, like, slightly more important, or, like, the micro, like, target selection stuff. But, like, with this other condition, this MSU condition, it's, like, I feel like it's a way to beat good players more reliably than table them. And that's why I play to it way more.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And I think that you also can, like, convert from one of these kinds of playstyles in another. Like, I mean, I talk about this every single podcast I can get on. If you are a worse player, you need to gamble more. If you are playing against someone who's better, like when I play against Cody, I have to gamble because Cody will beat me if we go to the full turns. If Cody has every action that he wants, he's going to win the game. So I absolutely need to generate risky things that will have big payoffs. And I think playing these kinds of styles allows for more room for that, because if you, you know, cuck your opponent into a position where they only have three activations that can do something, and you've pressured them down to that, and then you take a big risky play and you delete two of those, well, all of a sudden now you can, the game's over. There is no, you know, anything else. So it kind of plays into that too.
Mm-hmm. So to the point of what you were saying about, like, we think certain models could change and become more valuable based off of the ability to play to this win condition. And I think you're right. And like, if you're a keyword one trick, like you play Marcus and that's what you do, you should pick up an MSU list. Like, you should start playing, you know, with the snake boys or whatever they're called, like three of them. Why not? Try out MSU, see how it works. You may find that this matchup you've been struggling with, if you can tax that keyword enough with just being slightly, just making them more inefficient, then you don't need to shove a Cerebus down their face, right? Yeah. So to that point, what do you guys think are some of the abilities that really make a good, like, sort of MSU mod?
I think slow. I think giving slow quickly is probably really good. And then obviously by proxy, 2-inch reach, because it's slow without flips.
Yeah. So I'd argue that a lot of it is like tankiness of models, like how difficult they are to kill. And like the secondary to that is mobility, because that also makes them difficult to kill. Like that's kind of like part of what Silhouettes are doing, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're not easy to approach, and they're so mobile that approaching them just seems bad. Like, but it's definitely, so I guess if we're like going to categorize like actual abilities, like butterfly jump is really nice. Actual armor is something that could be used, but on top of that is like healing, because healing on armor models like negates whole attacks. I would say, you know, I almost want to put terrifying there, but that's more of like a resource tax. I don't know if it's taxing. It can tax actions, but
it's crit success taxes an action.
Yeah, but that's like a more risky approach to it, because it's not guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Like if they really want to hit something, they will, but it's like more of a tax if you are taxing their hand. So, but yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking for. Like just thinking about generic lists, like, I honestly think like Von Schill's crew fits that really well. Like they have a lot of these things going on. Like they have tankiness and mobility and like the ability to do all this stuff.
And he just turns condition one into condition zero or whatever. Condition zero into condition whatever. MSU.
Yeah, you should get a poll up so we can come up with a cool name for whatever.
what is a cool name?
Yeah, because I like condition zero. That we've all said that. We're like, yeah, that's right. We just discovered something from the all thing. It is given us the name of this. But yeah, okay, whatever the other one, it's not. It's not whatever we said. It's got some other name.
It's like, I don't know. It's like like buzzer beater or something. You're like sneaking in points at the last minute.
Oh man. Yeah, no, it's definitely not that. I don't know what. but regardless,
attrition, I guess, attrition play. Yeah, attrition. Like that's kind of what it is.
Attrition is a victory.
We'll figure out a cooler name later.
Attrition. Yeah. Condition zero is 100% attrition to me, but maybe that's a War Machine thing, because that was literally what attrition meant in War Machine.
Yeah, like, yeah, that's a War Machine.
The three conditions, win conditions of War Machine, were attrition, assassination, and scenario, and attrition just means kill models.
Okay, yeah. Like I'm more thinking of like draining actions as your attrition and not actual models, but I guess it makes more sense. Yeah. Just killing models.
You're just being annoying. That's the win condition. Be annoying.
Yeah. It's a pretty good win condition. You know, if you ever get to the table and your opponent says, no, fuck you, I'm leaving. That's, I mean, some people win the game before it starts. Like I'm just putting it out there. It happens.
It's like rope-a-dope. It's like the rope-a-dope win condition. Just have them,
it's
like,
definitely not that. You should get a pull up. Less,
tie themselves out swinging.
Oh man,
sure.
And yeah, less inbred decision making can happen. We can give this one to the community.
Yeah, yep. But I think So it's like partially the abilities on the models, and I feel like there's a big potential in the future for schemes to change to make this even better. Because like right now, Like, you can definitely push it, but it's like, there's definitely certain pools it just doesn't work in, but like, those could just change, and then suddenly the game is about burning more actions than your opponent and like trying to like do this stuff.
Like, yeah, like if there was a scheme or strat that just had like a huge flat cost, then it could be pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, symbols is kind of that already, because it requires so much movement to get to the other side of the board unless you're like certain like standout like crews. So like, I don't know. I haven't got to do this, but I want to play that same list in a symbols pool just so I could put three Will-O-Wisp on all the symbols and just play. Like, don't mind. Yeah, you can't score.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, oof.
That does sound annoying.
that sounds really obnoxious. Yeah. Oh my gosh. You can get an Adza too, so you can just get
all the bases.
One flex piece to just go wherever everybody else gets. Oh my gosh, that sounds awful.
So yeah, I think defensive is what we're talking about, but it's different than tanky, because like, I mean, like everyone gets tanky, right? You know, right. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of everyone's like first impulse would like recover evidence is like, okay, well, I'll bring five models that don't die. It's like, that's tanky, right? We get that.
Yeah.
But like with this other like MSU, like sort of style, it wouldn't be necessarily that great into recover, because like your stuff will die, but it'll die in a way that will like give you benefits other ways. So to that point, I think like, I don't know, like abilities that I like are like hard to kill. I think that is really good for this style, because it just flat means you're going to have to do another action, like plus one action to kill. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it just stops there at that one health.
No, that's definitely correct. I think that's the best way to use it too. So when you see, I think this is something that people miss too. A lot of the time they'll look at hard to kill and they'll see it on just like a big fat model. And they're like, okay, cool, whatever. But man, the cheaper that model is, the more brutal hard to kill gets. I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. Which maybe, so I think it would be fun to maybe write out some lists on the fly. Maybe we think about some list that we think could sort of play to this style. And actually one that I have been playing more against myself than anyone else is a Euripides MSU list.
Interesting.
And I like that because it has sort of those rules that I think are very taxing, right? So it was just Euripides with three Lysas, which are taxing because they're 5/5. They cost four, but they're 5/5, four health, and have incorporeal. So they have the same amount of wounds as their cost, even though they're incorporeal.
Oh, wow.
It's usually -1. And then two Gurions, which are 8 cost, but they're, you know, -3 and they have hard to kill.
Those models are so good.
Two Cyclops, -3, hard to kill. And then from there, you have 8 points. You can throw another Gigan in there because you don't have a henchman. So two stones is like fine-ish. Or you can add two upgrades to your Gigants or whatever.
Pause. You have Thune. Thune's a henchman.
Oh, I don't he's run Thune pushing, in this list.
He's pushing the MSU.
Oh, yeah. You're just saying he'd just never be afforded. Got it.
Pushing MSU. Yeah, yeah. So I don't need like that kind of security with Thune, because his whole thing is that he throws you in an ice pillar, and that can be like minus an action, but it's like more resource intensive. But like with this list, what it does is like it has 10 significant models. Most of them have hard to kill. The ones that don't have incorporeal, you can even give incorporeal to the ones that have hard to kill, while still also having five -3 models. So like the whole thing is like you can kill whatever you want, but whatever you kill is going to be more taxing than the amount you're like reducing my overall actions, right? Because I got all those Lysa, I got all the fucking Cyclops, I got all that shit. And yeah, that's a list that I've like. That's actually a
really cool list. Yeah, that was really fun. I'm going to save that. But give me to actually finish my Euripides stuff.
So yeah, I think summoners sort of like by default like have these lists. You know what I'm saying? Like you've done well with these lists.
Yeah.
But I think you could take these principles to other lists with things like that, where you're just saying like, you know, if you're not going to if the scheme pool does not punish you killing me, then I can, you know, tax you like we've been saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, so like think of another list. Like I'm honestly surprised more guild players don't play wardens because they kind of fit that really well.
Yeah, that's a perfect model for that.
Because they're both armored and they're really difficult to interact with, and they have an attack that just slows you. So like they're just always taking away so many actions from you, and they're just like always blocking a spot that you want to be in. It's just they're so annoying to deal with when you don't expect them to be there. Like there's just so much value happening. Maybe same thing with hunters. It might be a little crazy paying that much tax, but like what if you just randomly had a list that was Sonya, 2 wardens and 3 hunters and fill in the rest, like, and then suddenly like you have this weird, really mobile list with this like core that like Sonya and the wardens like slowing stuff down and just like picking stuff off while the hunters can like go off and do their thing and no one wants to mess with them. Like,
I think the ward, I mean, like, I think that could work just in Hoffman too, right? I mean,
yeah, straight up. Like I almost didn't want to say it cause it's just like pure tankiness, but like Hoffman is like a perfect example of this.
And you're right. If you declare Hoffman, then they know to tech in armor. But if they're not teching for the armor too, then the wardens get like double value.
Yeah.
But and even, some people just can't that much, right? Like, I mean, Bayou literally has a single anti. Like, just give fuck, nerd. Like, if someone ever brings like an MSU armor list against me, like, I'm not winning the game. I'm probably just buying us both beers and eating a pretzel or something. Like, I'd rather I'd really just rather not. Like, I'll just take the fucking L and save the mental bandwidth.
Okay, yeah. So I got a Hoffman list, 2 wardens, 2 hunters, 3 riot breakers. Everything has armor 2, and it's, what is it, 9 significant models?
What are the bad things? Is that the hunters?
The hunters are the dogs.
Yeah, the dogs that pounce on stuff.
So I just want to point out, I think hounds are actually good because of this kind of logic. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, right? Like you can create a hound list. Like I've been trying to say this for like 2 years. Like I think hounds are good in every faction because of this. Like they're so cheap. They're so fast. They just like screw your opponent's stuff. Like, and a lot of the time, by the time they're dead, like you've already gotten so much out of them. There's like what, 3 or for their cost, right? They're like 3 or 4 stones in almost every faction if memory serves. And a lot of them like get better the more of them there are. So you can get in these situations where like, okay, well, I've got to kill this stupid dog. And then another dog comes up and just like now 2 of them are like fighting someone. It gets awkward.
Yeah. I think the key to building one of these lists is to find like a nice overcosted cheap model that normally doesn't get played because it's like, well, I can't do anything. There's no like one-to-one role for it that other models have. Like, you know, I bring this because it's doing this scheme and bring this because it's doing this. But like these like cheaper models that are a little overcosted, like I think the Lysa is overcosted for its survivability being only 4 stones. The Will-O-Wisp is like slightly, did I say overcosted? I meant undercosted.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you're saying overcosted, you mean cheaper
the other word.
Man, what's the strategy here? Wow, it's like, this is some really obtuse logic.
And like the Will-O-Wisp too, it's like undercosted for the amount of like actions it takes to remove it. So I think that's like a good starting point for finding these kind of lists.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that because they're just easy quagmires to exist.
The one I've had like more actual success and not theoretical success with is Von Schill. Like I don't like playing his tanky models because if I declare Von Schill and my opponent is good and I guess not playing Bayou, they're going to bring the anti-armor, anti-shielding tech. So like playing the big tanky models who rely on that stuff feels like a disrespect play. But I have like really enjoyed like triple scouts because they just shoot 14 inches away. They shoot twice every turn. It doesn't matter if they hit. I'm never giving a card to them. They ignore every defensive tech. Like, you know, double librarians, you know, just like soldiers. And like, it's so I don't have to give any severes to the list for it to be sort of both taxing or like
efficient. Getting the value out of flipping so many cards because you're just eventually you're gonna hit like because you're just taking so many actions. So
you guys just keep talking about how good Somer is without saying Somer's really good.
That's not what this is about right now.
I'm just gonna slip that in. Somer's really good for everything we've said this entire podcast. Yeah, yeah, he's good at every part of this.
Freaking good old boys. They're like this to a T, right?
They're crazy tacks. They're hard as fuck to kill. They defend like a motherfucker. Like, they're just crazy. And then criers are equally like hard to kill. Like, you can't. It's like if you're too close to them, they can obey you and you're on negatives. So you're going somewhere and they're choosing where. It's, I have thought about playing a list that's just straight three good old boys, three criers, and like some spit hogs and stuff, and just like abandoning Georgina Olaf and the rest of the expensive guys. Going straight into like, okay, cool, here's all my stuff, and you are never getting through it. And then like you just summon just tons of bio gremlins every turn, and just like, okay, cool, I'm gonna summon my four or five bio gremlins and put them in melee with all your people. Yeah, yeah, this is the most evil list.
I'm getting a dojo boner off of this one.
Yeah, it's a real truth. It's not a list I'd bring in everything, right? Though I would bring that list that I'm describing right now into your Hoffman armor list because it would just
plink.
It's like, okay, well, if you're doing nothing, I'm gonna do nothing, and I've got criers. So
yeah, I can
interact. My doing nothing. Exactly. Yeah, I hope to God they don't take that away from us when they.
Yeah, this list is sick. Good old boy, triple crier, and a spit hog.
How many points we've left over after the spit hog?
Five. That's five stones.
Five. Oh well, we can't go below that. Yeah, five minimum for Somer. The boss has to get.
He's got to have a cranky coins.
You abandon old cranky.
And that faction already like basically works that way, even without doing that. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why it's like the opportunity cost is fairly.
Yeah.
The benefit is that instead of investing your first turns to summon criers and good old boys, you're instead just summoning a pile of actual bio gremlins. Yeah, and even if like suck your opponents, and even if your opponent's like, okay, well, I'm just not going to walk up and I'm just going to like play it safe and stay away or whatever. It's like, okay, cool. I'm going to summon four riflemen sitting next to each other like they're in the Revolutionary War. And next round, I'm going to summon four more behind them. And we're just going to start crunching out a pile of shots at you, and you can just crunch through them and kill them as you please. Well, because again, it doesn't matter if they miss.
I would also surrender if I saw you playing this list, but for different reasons. And that's because I know we're not going to see turn three.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And this is the whole point. You just want to slow it down as much as possible so you can just go get that pretzel.
Well, that's not the win condition. The win condition
is it's a win condition for sure. If you ever concede against me, it's definitely a win condition.
Oh, I guess.
We're talking about alternative.
Have I been touched? It seems I have. Oh. It's the same as being like, well, if you don't shower enough, your BO is a win condition.
It's an alternative win condition. We're talking about oblique play. I mean, it's not good for anything else.
Disagree in your tone about how you find control not fun, because I find it very fun. When my Will-O-Wisp top decks the Crow Trigger, dude, I'm having a good fucking time.
Oh, I love control. I play control on all my lists. Yeah, I don't. Did I ever say I didn't like control? I love control. I'm like a big Sultai player from Magic. So it's just like, I'm going to kill everything you have, and I'm going to tempo you out. I'm going to interact as much as possible with all the things you don't want me to interact with. I just love that style of play where you're just like building up value over time. And I think that, you know, like summoners is like the most low hanging fruit we have here, but there's like, I would encourage people who just play one or two keywords, because I know there's people out there who do that for theme reasons or whatever. I doubt they're listening to your podcast, but you know, the three people who are, the thematic players who are just like, I'm gonna listen to Swamp Fiends this week because I want to, maybe he'll talk about my two crews I play. But if those people exist, or the people who are, you know, focusing more towards that, like, just try weird shit with your keyword.
You clearly don't pay attention to the Discord, because the Swamp Fiend community is primarily snowflakes.
Oh no.
That's all we talk about all day.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
So I got one more that I think may be good. Let me run it by you guys. I was thinking about other four stone models that I think are like really like shitty, like annoying. And
yeah, they're just bastards.
I was thinking about the Dead Dandy in Red Chapel.
That card is so brutal. Like, yeah. I remember seeing him the first time and just being like, what the fuck is this? And I've never seen one on a table.
I've seen one in like, you know, a few games, but I feel like if you bring Sheamus, you bring three of these, why the fuck not? Because they're four cost, five health, and they have disguise, hard to wound, and manipulative, which is just all three of the like, oh, no, that's extra actions. You cannot kill me without extra actions. And then they have the bonus action to turn a scheme or a corpse into a scheme or corpse. So like, not only are they hard to kill, they threaten all of your schemes. You can't score schemes while they're able to double walk and like flip your scheme to their scheme.
Man, you could also play that with like undead. So that way you could just turn, because it's like the what, 2-point undead kind of corpses.
Zombies,
you could just turn zombies, that's it. Yeah. So you just turn them into
like off-carried emissary. Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be pretty cool.
I mean, it's funny because actually during the World Cup earlier this year, one of my opponents did play Sheamus and he did bring Dead Dandy. It was like a one of, but it actually scored him. It had a stitch I summoned off the Widow Weaver, like stuck on it the whole game because he just couldn't kill him. And eventually the Dead Dandy just like walked around the stitch and ate a scheme. Like, and it was so brutal.
I think that Sheamus is probably another one that like people just don't play this playstyle. They try and play weird other stuff. And I think this is 100% Sheamus's playstyle. Like he goes in, he deletes the one model that he can't interact with or isn't going to like, I guess you kill the thing that's like going to handle all this stuff efficiently. Like the guy who ignores armor or the guy who ignores manipulative or whatever. And then you just back up. And you just let everybody just else scheme. Just be a quagmire. Yeah.
Like, honestly, I've seen people scheme with them way more than actually shoot things. Like,
it seems just really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like an untapped one, too. Because, again, a lot of the time, I think it's going to be the masters you're not seeing as much. For those Bayou players who think that I'm about to say Wong is playable, you can get the fuck out of here. He's still dog shit. He's trash. He will never be good.
The flying piglets, dog. In the SU.
Yeah. The flying piglets are really sweet in Zip. Not in Wong. Get it like, ugh. Wong is unplayable. I just had to deal with that because I knew I was going to get a message at like 4 a.m. from someone in like Czechoslovakia, who's like, I heard you think Wong's playable.
Please, everyone in the Discord, send Oliver messages about how Wong is.
Please, I will block your ass. I don't give a fuck. It's like I'm doing it.
So, the typical Sheamus list is right. It's like Carrion Emissary, like, and before in GG0, I don't think it's changed much in GG1. It was definitely like Archie Manos, Carrion Emissary, and then like sprinkle in some flavor from there. And that's like pretty good if you need to like rush down the opponent and like kill some range models. But
yeah, it's if like you fine.
Run this list, which is basically just all the cheap shit and it all has disguised, their melee models can't kill shit. Like imagine turn one, so I got two dead doxies, three dead dandies, three rotten bells, a grave digger. That's 10 significant models. Most of them have disguised and manipulative or even better on the doxies. Like imagine Sheamus like ports up, kills one of your six stone models, ports back. Everything else in the crew stands on not just your deployment line, like your deployment edge.
Yeah, just hangs
like, what do you do? It's like, oh, you want to do that again? I'll just kill another model.
Yeah.
And then we'll keep doing this until you don't have enough AP to wade through this shit. Like,
yep. It sounds awful. And that's the thing. Like, like the first time I saw Sheamus, I was like, God, this dude looks so fucking rough. But luckily, I was playing against Jared, so he just bumblefucked his way into getting murdered by my whole crew. But, I mean, at some point, Nick's going to put that shit on the table, and I'm going to go get a pretzel.
Cool. All right. Do you guys have any other ideas, or think we're wrapping up?
Yeah, I think the only other one is just the... the Ulix. I think Ulix is probably. So, I think there. Oh, yeah. I think there actually is an Ulix list with piglets. As much as it's like almost a meme, I think it's like actually the real thing.
Yeah, so like when you're talking about the deployment thing, almost like another way you could do this is like part of it is just sitting in your deployment. Like there are games where I played a summoner and all my entire crew is at my table edge because like I want to push that like length advantage, like how many turns I can summon safely before I'm like in a fight. Like if I'm up against Lady J and I'm playing like a summoner. Or like anyone that's kind of like this, like I can see benefits for just like actually being at the back of your deployment because they have so much more to spend to like reach you when it's a list about being aggressive.
Yeah, I played against that once and it was terrible. Like Matt did that to me a single time and he crushed me in the ground. And Matt's a guy locally. He paints terribly, but. Intentionally. Seems I'm not. Yeah. No, he uses apple barrels intentionally because he hates painting requirements and he paints them really bad on purpose. But he was playing, I think it was Sand. Was it Sandeep? Nick, I bitched about this game so much.
It might have been Kalea because she's.
It was Kalea. Yeah, it was definitely. Yeah,
super
yeah,
mobile. So.
Yeah, so he played a Kalea list where he literally just didn't leave his deployment for like two turns. He just well, none of those games need me to do this. So I'm just like, you have to come to me to score. So
yeah. Cause yeah. I felt like that always came up with like, the old kill mission. Reckoning. Yeah. Reckoning like that. That yeah. was just, there's literally never a reason to move forward unless like you're about to score in the last turn. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Public enemies is just as bad, but yeah, it's like, I hate those pools where they don't force you to go anywhere. Like,
yeah.
They just shouldn't. It's not.
Yeah. Even. You usually just means there's a bad pool, but sometimes you're like the tournament master, game master.
TO.
I don't know what you call it. TO. Yeah. There thank you, you. I don't know why that was so difficult. But yeah, I mean, sometimes the TO just randoms them though. Right. I mean, we've all been to that event. Is there any other like crews you guys can think of?
One thing I was going to say about what Nick was saying is I've dabbled a little bit in Yoko lately, and I feel like that's how she has to play. She has to like sit on your deployment edge for at least like two turns because she can't like fight. She has to just wait till her pass tokens are like the pass token like engine is generated so that you have that advantage. Otherwise, you're just like,
I mean, isn't she just like 10 Thunders Wong? Like, she's just not playable. She's got Hinamatsu.
Pretty close.
But yeah, but Hinamatsu is just a random model.
I think the reason it's Evermore like that is like her stats are so low, like the whole crew across, and you have to rely on those pluses and pass tokens to like actually do stuff.
Yeah, like before it should just then, be like normal.
You're supposed to like pressure their hand before that, but it doesn't work very well, like without you dying.
I think she has a good list that I'll say. And the list requires second master McCabe.
Okay.
Because what you get with Yoko, in my opinion, is you get the front of her card because the back of her card is like empirically like the worst master card.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So you, what the front of the card gives you is the minus one hand who, I mean, that's fine, but it's like not great, but it gives you like access to hiring all of these models that give you pass tokens. And it gives you like some slight hand advantage stuff, but the problem is you don't have master AP to use your 13s on. So I bring in McCabe. Now I have a master to throw 13s on. And he can also play control style with his gun and delay enough to where the pass token engine can get off like online. But even then, I don't think it's like,
like he could just be McCabe.
It's like an oblique list. Yeah. It's like an oblique list that like, you have to have a reason you're dropping it into the pool, and that is like to score a specific scheme, like catch and release with the big orange hair guys or something like that.
I think that's something else. So like for those who are trying to like look at this stuff, I think the important thing is to understand when you want to do these kinds of things too, and you don't learn the answer to that without just doing it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can get in these positions where you're like, well, you know, in context, I never choose this, right? Or opportunity cost, are basically saying that like this is never going to be a decision, but you really can't know how crazy something is until you put it on the table. And I think that's part of the reason a lot of us enjoy playing these kinds of games in our weekly games and stuff like that. Just because you start seeing these lines of play. I mean, it's probably my next focus this year is to like break Ulix, like just for that reason. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it's super fun to like crack something and be like, oh, I'm the person who figured this out. And Malifaux is small enough that like, if you figure out a resource, like, yeah, you can probably figure out how to break it or like create a list around it.
Oliver, that's snowflaking, dog.
Is that snowflaking? What's snowflaking? It's I assume like snowflaking was like complaining about stuff on the internet.
No, it's like play. It's trying to be a special, unique snowflake. This is my thing. You know, I'm the Ulix guy. I figured it out.
Oh, I thought. Yeah, I just call that ego.
You're like, home. You're dope, home. You're dude. Home.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Ego, baby, hell yeah.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up. I think it's given our listeners and myself and hopefully you guys a lot to think about in terms of maybe tapping into some more of these type of lists. Do you guys have any sort of plugs or shout outs or anything you want to add at the end here?
Oh man. I run the Bayou Facebook group. So if you ever want to be added to that, you're welcome to message me. I'll add you to the group or the messenger chat. Other than that, not a bunch. If you ever have questions about Bayou stuff, you can always message me as well, though. Or, you know, communist theory. Always happy to talk about that.
Yeah, so have you probably heard before, I have a website that I'm posting stuff on. It's not always about Malifaux. It's called buildingbettergames.net. I'm also on Cody's Discord, so Swamp Fiends, so if you want to message me there about stuff. And if you have, I guess a recent thing is, like, I'm competing in Masters of Runeterra. So if you want to get better at that game, go ahead and send me some questions.
Yeah, Nick's really smart, and he's good at a lot of games.
What is Masters of Runeterra? Oh, that's the
Legends League of Runeterra. That's the League card game. It's a very good card game. I really like it, and I recommend it to anyone who's ever played a card game because it's better than all of them. So
I play that a lot, too, but I am nowhere near as good, so don't reach out to me for advice. I'll just message Nick.
I have a very dumb reason why I didn't like that game. But
oh, yeah.
Is it the art? Is it just like, I mean, we're all humans.
I didn't like the handshaking. I didn't like that I play a card and then we both have to say, like, okay, a bunch. I don't know. I actually like playing against the computer for that reason. Like, when I was playing it, but I didn't like playing against other people because it was like, fucking just hit okay. Like, you know, like, I didn't like that stuff. But that's a dumb reason to dislike it.
I'm sure. So they've updated that. So it auto does it 99% of the time. If really? You don't have a plan, it fires off immediately. Okay. And now they've added timing. So if you time out so many times, you lose.
Yeah, it's
if
like you, three timeouts you're just out of the game. So
yeah, it's pretty fresh.
It's good that it auto does it because I was playing against like, what's the spider chick? Like, everyone's playing the spider chick at the beginning and like she just like does something after every single action. Like, there was like five handshakes that had to occur, but now that it auto does it,
it's a lot smoother and
yeah, it's really clean.
It's only when you actually have a choice. Like if you're out of mana, like it's always just going to pass. But yeah, I recommend it.
It's super good.
It's a good card game. It's fun.
I just realized that when I said my Discord is full of snowflakes, you thought I was saying like my Discord is full of like SJWs.
Yeah, 100%. I was like, cool, dude, I guess. Yeah, that's sweet. Like, I argue with people on Twitter all day. Like, it's cool, sweet, awesome. I was like, we all have our vices. We all lost something in the pandemic.
No, I just mean the Discord is mostly people who are like trying to figure out how to play Raspy. Oh my God, that's fucking
hilarious. This is why language is trash and we should all build better language.
What are you doing in my swamp?